My name is Daniel Shoptaw, an Arkansas accountant with a love for the Cardinals. I spent a lot of years watching the game before deciding to write about it. Now I express my thoughts and opinions at C70 at the Bat, part of the Cardinal Conclave. His name is Dan Buffa, a former Busch Stadium scoreboard operator with a passion for the game. His writing talents can be found throughout the internet on a variety of topics, including movies and anything St. Louis. You'll find him often bleeding out words at stlouissportsminute.com. Every week, we pool our knowledge and our opinions to create this podcast. Together, we are the best Dans in baseball. Welcome in to the last Best Dans in Baseball for 2015. I know we got your hopes up there when we said last Best Dans, and maybe you thought we were done for good. But no, we'll be back in 2016, most likely. I'm Daniel Shoptaw. That's Dan Buffo. It's been about 3 weeks since we have done this. This is episode 23. Those 3 weeks have been fairly quiet weeks. That's what happens when you get around the holidays at the baseball offices, just like pretty much any professional business, kind of shut down, and they have their office parties, and they're off, and people are here and there and everywhere, and so not much gets done. But the Cardinals have done one significant thing. There have been a couple of minor league moves and things like that, but the one significant thing is to bring in Mike Leake on a 5-year deal, $80 million. I get why the Cardinals felt like they needed to do this, but after chasing David Price and after chasing Jason Hayward, man, Mike Leake is a bit of a downer, don't you think?
Yeah, and I just want to include that even though we will be back for 2016, I haven't popped out after every episode of Best Dans of Baseball. just want to put that out there, folks. But yeah, I mean, Mike Leake, you know, when that deal happened, it was really kind of a solid signing. But yeah, it's always going to be a come down when it comes after the loss of Price and the loss of Hayward with all the bats out there. I mean, unless Mike Leake can hit in a lineup every other day that he's not pitching, it's just you're still sitting there looking at the lineup that needs help. But, you know, the more I thought about Leake, you know, I mean, I think this is a quality signing. When you look at what he can do, he's not being counted on to be a top of the rotation guy. He's essentially going to give this rotation some stability as Michael Wacha and Carlos Martinez grow into their innings as their careers expand, and with Lance Lynn being out, I think it's a good reactionary move. I mean, with as far as what you could have done, I mean, you see what Scott Kazmir got today from the Dodgers and Jeff Samardzija. I think the Jeff Samardzija deal really just kind of laid out the outline of every other kind of second tier, third tier pitcher is going to get. So, you know, he's 28 years old. He's pitched in the Central Division. He's the kind of guy that relies on kind of contact. I made a comparison to Jeff Suppan. You know, Kyle Loesch is another one. Kind of a guy that comes here with not much of a sparkling upside, but could be a nice addition over the years.
Yeah, you look at it. Of course, the raw numbers are not necessarily that interesting. I'm looking at his splits, his career splits. He has been better away from his home park, which until the last half of last year was Great American Ballpark, which is not a pitcher's ballpark. So it's good to know that that's, you know, he can pitch better on the road. He's going into Busch Stadium, which typically plays as at least slightly a pitcher's park. So that's a big extreme. You know, but glancing at this, I think one thing that jumps out at me just at a glance is that August and September are not real good for him in typical. You know, if you just look at it by ERAs, his ERA is 4.73 in August and 4.56 in September and October, and he's got a sub-500 record in that time period. Now, it's hard to know. I mean, he's in Cincinnati, and a number of those years they've been out of the race, and, you know, maybe he's got other, you know, weaker lineups behind him as they're trying out people, stuff like that. But, you know, for a team that expects to go deep into the postseason, it's a little disconcerting to see a guy that tends to, at least by the numbers, looks like he wears down after the All-Star break. Now, that being said, if everybody's healthy, Mike Leake's probably not in your postseason rotation, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, if you have all your top four guns working, I mean, when it comes to the guys that you rely on, I mean, you have Adam Wainwright's going to be back. You know, you have... You're going to have Waka and Martinez. You're going to have Jaime Garcia, who's always going to be in that conversation. You know, and it's a very interesting take about how he does. He also kind of has a little more problem as he gets through the lineup and during a game. I think during the third time through the lineup, he kind of gets beaten up a little bit. You know, there's a lot of reasons to like this signing, and there's a few good reasons that kind of go, okay, it's just not that exciting of an addition. I mean, if the Cardinals would have landed Hayward and they would have gotten Mike Leake, I think we'd be looking at this trade a lot differently. But because it's kind of the only that, you know, Jed Jerko, it's the one big signing the Cardinals have made. That's why everybody's kind of down on it. And yeah, I mean, I would kind of hope to see Mike Leake in a playoff rotation, and that is unless Jaime Garcia does enough to earn it. But yeah, right now, I mean, if you look at the in this rotation, everybody's really going the way they should. He's kind of really a fourth or fifth starter at best, and you know, I guess, you know, market value, that's what it costs you. But I think he could be also one of those guys that maybe surprises you. I mean, hearing Adam Wainwright talk about him in the way that he, you know, that maybe he comes into Derek Lilliquist and with this staff, and they kind of make him an even more of a better pitcher. Maybe they figure out a way to make his stuff a little bit more durable and last in August and September. Maybe he has a chance to surprise. But, you know, on paper and on – especially seeing what he did with the San Francisco Giants last year, his – you know, and looking at his fielding independent pitching, those kind of things make you have a little bit of pause. But maybe that's just the way that he can surprise us down the road.
Maybe. I've got a pretty good relationship with a Giants blog and was interacting a little bit with the author over there. And, you know, they were not fond of Mike Leake last year. I don't think they necessarily thought they needed to trade for him. And then he was hurt a lot while he was out there. Didn't feel like he ever produced anything. You know, that's a small sample size. That's a guy getting traded for the first time, you know, but it is a little, you know, it's a data point, you know, take it for what it's worth. You know, Mike Leake is insurance, and buying insurance is never fun and it's never exciting. And it's never something that you say, hey man, I want to go out and buy some insurance, but you've got to have it. I mean, it's kind of one of those things. And that's the thing. I don't know that Mike Leake is going to pitch significantly better than what we could have seen out of Tim Cooney and Tyler Lyons and Marco Gonzalez, a three-headed monster maybe in that fifth row spot. But you're pretty sure that he's going to give you close to 200 innings. You're pretty sure what you're going to get from him, because those other three are a little bit more unestablished. They could be great. They could be terrible. They could be in the back, you know, back and forth. Leake's probably going to be a little bit more consistent.
Or they could be trade chips now. Maybe that. Yeah. I kind of talk about the way that Leake acquisition kind of made. Getting Leake makes a guy like Garcia maybe floatable, especially Tim Cooney, maybe Marco Gonzalez, and a possible deal with the Rockies if that ever becomes a reality. I mean, when I think of Leake, I think of here's a guy that you know what he is. He isn't going to be anything special. He's never going to be a number one or two. But he can allow you to float one of these guys, these young guys with upside. You know, Marco Gonzalez, he had that one great half a season, had the shoulder problems. You know, Jaime Garcia has a nice option. What if he pitches really good? Can the Cardinals float him away? Because Lance Lynn is going to be back in 2017. But and yeah, I do. I think that's a great way to put it. I think he is just kind of like the insurance. You know, it's like Jed Jerko is kind of just, you know, the insurance behind a Colton Wong or a Johnny Peralta, especially in the second half when maybe they might wear down. Insurance for Ledmus Diaz if he isn't ready to be that guy down the road in the middle infield. I think Leake is just one of those guys that, because of the way and the manner that he came to the Cardinals, I just think Cardinal fans just kind of shrug their shoulders. And, you know, and the way he finished last year and your comments from that Giants blog, maybe you just go in expecting bad things, and he might be a very, you know, he might surprise you. I guess I'm looking for the guy to give me innings, because the Cardinals, they lost those innings from Lynn and Lackey. Mm-hmm. And maybe he can swing the bat a little bit, maybe not be an automatic out in a ninth spot. But I just think this is all going to look better if the Cardinals go out there and make another move, because I think, you know, you get Jerko, you get Leake. I still see a lineup that's going to have a hard time scoring runs.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, like you say, when Leake's main selling point to some people, and mainly tongue-in-cheek, was the fact that he's, you know, got a 215 or so average as a pitcher, and he's got some, you know, a little bit better bat than you would normally see out of a guy that goes every fifth day. Yeah, you've still got some problems. You know, you talk about those guys being available for trade, and perhaps and Mo still seems to be very hesitant to make a trade, which is understandable. I mean, it's going to take some, you know, the farm system's not what it was, and there's not exactly just overflowing bounty as there used to be, and so, you know, they've got money. We know they've got money after what they've offered people. They'd be much more likely to spend that money. Now, again, Mo has continued to say, hey, we're happy with what we've got, and I think you wrote it, and maybe Redbird Rants today, you know, there are a lot of ifs that Mo may be counting on. If they go the Cardinals' way, hey, yeah, this could be a tolerable offense, but even if they all go Cardinals' way, I don't know that it's a great offense, and there's not likely that all of them are going to go the Cardinals' way.
Yeah, I mean, you're hinging on a lot of hypotheticals when it comes to, you know, if Holiday can bounce back to his 2014 form, that's great. If Grichuk, you know, if Grichuk can stay healthy all season, you're looking at maybe a 30 home run guy. Piscotty could be a 20 home run, 80 RBI guy. But it just depends if these guys stay healthy, how they react to full seasons. You know, Piscotty, a full season now in the major leagues, how pitchers, are they going to get an angle on how to get him out? What will Colton Wong do? I mean, he's a big question mark this season because he saw some of his numbers go up last year overall, but he had that big second half decline. Is Johnny Peralta going to do better now that he has insurance behind him? It's just, I mean, what can, you know, Ledmus Diaz, the guy finished 2015 in Memphis in a flourish. He hit well in the Arizona Fall League. Can he be a guy that surprises this year? You just don't see a difference maker. You know, Hayward wasn't a big offensive guy, but he was a consistent hitter in this lineup from May 1st till the end of the year. I mean, and yeah, if this happens and this happens, maybe the Cardinals can score more than two to three, you know, maybe three runs a game. Because, I mean, I don't see this pitching staff being an historically good pitching staff again. And you just can't make those kind of gambles. I mean, you can't come back to the casino 2 years in a row and think you're going to be rolling the same amount of dice with the pitching staff, especially when they got Mike Matheny as your coach, or as your manager who wants to, you know, overuse this guy and overuse that guy. And you don't know what you're going to get from this pitching staff on the whole with so many leaky objects. Like, you know, you got, there's leaky, there's the pun. But, you know, I mean, Michael Wacha in his second full season, Carlos Martinez and that shoulder injury, you know, you don't know who's going to be your starting five on July 1st. But just the way this Cardinals rotation does happen. But, you know, seeing a full season of Wainwright just kind of gives me good feelings about the rotation over the whole season. But every time I think about this offense, I just think, you know, have they gotten better from last season or have they gotten worse? And, you know, you can say a full season of Grichuk and Piscotty will be great, but that's like, you know, hoping Tommy Pham's going to be healthy all year. It's just, it's a stretch. And, you know, guys are getting older. Yadier Molina, you know, he's got those thumb injuries. I mean, is he going to be a guy that's going to be forced to pit in the middle of your lineup, or can he finally be in the bottom of your lineup? I just think that, you know, if we're not going to get the big guy, I mean, because you saw what I think last night, there's some rumors about the White Sox going after Cespedes and how his contract demands are really monstrous. And you see if he's getting this reportedly, then what are the other guys going to be asking for? But I just think the Cardinals, especially in the outfield, they need some insurance. Even Geraldo Parra, the guy, you know, who's good defensively, gets on base. Just guys that can get in there in case Grichuk's elbow blows up, in case Pham pulls an inner muscle, in case Piscotty gets hurt. You know, there's also, you know, John Nagel, Cardinals farm over at the Rue Court, wrote tonight about Brandon Moss. Are people underestimating him? Because if he's fully back from hip surgery, can he do what he did in 2014? There's just a lot of what ifs in this offense, and it doesn't make for a comfortable feeling going into the next season.
Yeah, I think that you could say that this offense is at best adequate. Doable. I mean, it's if you couple it with pretty good pitching, you can make a significant run. But is it better than last year? I don't think you can say that. I mean, the loss of Hayward is huge. I mean, he's the best hitter on the team. And even if you expect a bounce back from Holiday and you expect more from Piscotty, although, again, how much more can you expect out of Piscotty? Things like that, I just don't think you could, even with all that combined, I'm not sure that you could say that it's a better offense without Jason Hayward. So, you know, there are lots of outfielders still out there, and that price has got to be dropping, you would think, on some of these guys.
I would think so. That's why last night when I heard that, now, granted, it was from a Chicago White Sox blog, Bob Nightingale of the USA Today kind of came out today and kind of shot down that White Sox were closed. But, you know, when it was like, you know, if Cespedes is getting like up to $20 or $21 million a year, I just don't see it because, I mean, this is weeks later. I mean, we're almost into January, and the Hayward deal kind of should have really kicked the door off of this free agent market, and it really hasn't, you know? I mean, we haven't seen Justin Upton move. We haven't seen – I know Chris Davis is a first baseman. We haven't seen him go anywhere. I mean, the Orioles pulled their offer away from him. Cespedes, I don't even know what this guy wants because, you know, the Mets had the extra money from Kadir retiring, and they didn't go after him. So there's red flags with certain guys, and there's, you know, I mean, as the price from these guys drop below the nine-digit mark, I mean, and nine figures, I mean, is it one of these things where now can Mo re-enter these talks? I mean, I think their prices have to be dropping every week.
It would seem to be. In fact, I mean, you talk about a guy like Upton, I have not even heard his name.
I mean, at all.
I mean, you hear about the Royals and Alex Gordon, and even though they don't seem to be wanting to get him back necessarily, I think they're still kind of in the hunt. Like you said, yeah. Cespedes' name gets brought up. It sounds like the Mets aren't going to go get him, but like you said, White Sox and some others. I mean, you just never hear Justin Upton's name. And you wonder, I mean, is somebody put out there, maybe in Jason Stark, maybe in somebody else, that some of the, maybe Buster Olney, that put out the idea that maybe some of these guys are to a point where they'll sign a one-year deal,
yeah,
and then bounce back, you know, have a good season, and the market is thinner next year, and so they can maybe make that money back. I don't know if the Cardinals want to do that, but, you know, it would be reasonable to say, okay, we'll gamble here. I mean, we did that with Hayward, you know, except that it cost Shelby Miller and Terrell Jenkins instead of money,
yeah.
But, you know, maybe they do that. Maybe they say, okay, we'll bring you in here, and, you know, if something doesn't work out. The problem with that is, of course, losing the draft pick, but you got two from Chicago. Again, we've talked about this a lot, and bringing in an outfielder just makes way too much sense for this not to happen at some point in time.
Yeah, it does. And it's just, it's one of those things where, you know, you bring in an outfielder like Cespedes. If he's got red flags and he can't get that big deal, I can see him going, hey, Al, let me do a one-year deal and prove that I can produce at a 4-5, 6-4 level, and then I can get my big 4-5 year deal. Because eventually, you know, Chris Davis and Upton, these guys aren't seeing deals, or they're seeing deals yanked away. You know, you might even see Alex Gordon say, here, I'll play for a year. I mean, because Alex Gordon was hurt last year. You know, he only played a partial year. He didn't, you know, his first year in five seasons that he didn't win a gold glove. Maybe he goes, okay, here, I'll accept a one-year deal, and then I'll prove my worth, and then I'll get my parachute 3 or 4 year deal. I can definitely see that. Because, I mean, here we are with, you know, 3 to 4 guys that are still, I mean, well, 3 guys with Gordon and Upton and Cespedes. Then you have Chris Davis. You know, you have these guys that are just kind of sitting out there. And, you know, I don't see a lot of teams going, okay, let's go back to the table and offer this guy a ridiculous amount of money. I see teams kind of coming down and going, okay, I'm just going to go into the season with what I have and then make a trade. You know, I mean, for the way I saw a guy like Cespedes maybe going to the Orioles, who pulled their offer away from Davis because Cespedes fits what they need. I mean, they can move some pieces around. I also could see Cespedes going to the White Sox. It made like a decent fit, but now they're not even close. So it just makes you think, like, I mean, are these guys agents just trying to be like Scott Boras wannabes? Are they asking for too many years, too much money? I think it's always going to be the amount of seasons they want. I think a lot of GMs will pay a lot of money over a shorter amount. You saw the Dodgers pay Scott Kazmir, you know, what, $16 million over 3 years because they need a pitcher. And, you know, a lot of teams still need hitting. I mean, you know, even the Nationals need a hitter because the Nationals lost out on Hayward, too. I want to say that it's going to heat up soon, but I thought it would heat up right after December 11th. I thought it would just, you know, those guys would have been off the market within the next week. But, you know, the holidays happen, and maybe now that the holidays are getting over, especially after New Year's Day and after you get into the new year and spring training is about, you know, 6 weeks away, maybe you might see that market maybe, you know, find a little bit more of a more energy.
Well, we remember that Matt, you know, back when Matt Holliday signed with the Cardinals, he didn't sign until January.
He did not, yeah.
Of course, I don't think there was the market crush that there is this year. I mean, we're talking about one player, best player probably on that market, but just one player versus 4 to 5. And, you know, the draft pick is probably a factor for some people. I mean, there comes a point where the price is good enough that you give up that pick. But for some teams, that price needs to be pretty low. Because they really want to get that controllable young talent into the system. And the Cardinals, especially, being that they really do need a little bit of a restock, although they've got some people down farther in the system, and they've got some coming, they wouldn't mind having that extra pick. But given what they've getting out of Chicago, again, you'd think that they could give that up if the price is right. But we will see if that ever gets that low. It seems like it should, but, you know, we're not in baseball, and baseball has its own ideas sometimes.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy because, really, if I'm in Chris Davis's shoes, what Baltimore offered you was really good. I mean, it's a place mm-hmm. you like to hit. It's a place you're comfortable in. I mean, you could be a first baseman, right fielder, DH, and he turns down that money, and I just want to know what's going through him and his agent's mind. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, yeah, you had a great – you've been electric. 3 out of the last 4 seasons. Well, what I think people are getting scared off about him is his 2014 season where he hit below 200. Mm-hmm. He had kind of a very, very kind of normal year. I think that's what's really scaring these folks off is that he's going to be like the next Ryan Howard, a guy who just kind of hits for power, but then all of a sudden sees a lot of his other stuff just kind of drop off. Nobody wants to pay that $25 million a year in 3 or 4 years. So I was very surprised to see when the Orioles actually made that 7-year, $150 million offer. Like, you know, that's good money, man. I mean, you're 30 years old. That takes you to your 37 years old. It's a place you love hitting in. So when I saw him turn that down, I want to know what's going through your head.
Yeah, I mean, with Davis, it's always been, for me, it's always been, you know, the strikeouts are big.
Yeah.
And it's just a power. I mean, his average is okay, but his game is so dependent on his power. And if you start paying into his late 30s, you know, that power is probably going to decline, and there's not much there to go with it. So, yeah, I think that there's some people, especially if he said, hey, I'll play for 3 years.
Yeah, $25 million. You know, give him 3 years at 70. I mean, I like to give one of these guys, you know, even 4 years at like 90. You know, pay him a good amount per season. You know, maybe even give them, you know, I mean, a 3 or 4 year deal isn't the end of the road for these guys. I mean, if they have a good contract, they can, you know, that they could potentially get another contract after it. I just think that some of these guys are losing value and losing dollars by holding out, waiting for that big contract. It's probably not coming.
Yeah, it probably isn't. So, again, that's going to be interesting to see how long that takes. You know, it would seem like you say, first couple weeks in January, you would think. But, you know, I mean, you remember Kyle Loesch didn't sign a deal until into spring training. And it seems unlikely that many of these outfielders are going to wait that long. But, you know, somebody might. Justin Upton might be still out there once pitchers and catchers report.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I can see it. The Nationals going after Upton because if they wanted Hayward that bad, I mean, Upton's, a you know, 2 years older. He's got pop. He's played in, he's played against these same teams. So, you know, he's played with he's played in Arizona. He's played in San Diego. He's played in a lot of these. You know, he's very familiar with the National League. And I mean, I could see him going to Washington. I could see Davis maybe going back to Baltimore. Cespedes to the White Sox, and then the Cardinals get nobody. You know, for some reason, I still think the Cardinals are going to take another look at either of these guys. It'll be Alex Gordon, just because maybe he's a guy that might retrack, and you know, maybe go for the higher, the higher value, more money for maybe a shorter contract, especially after his injury plagued year last year. I think that's the kind of player that Mo would like. It just, you know, you have, I mean, can he play right field? Is he willing to play right field? It's just, there's so many ifs there's ifs with the Cardinals offense, and there's a lot of ifs and buts with these free agents.
There is. So I don't know. I we'll have to wait and see. And that may be something we can – hopefully we'll have something to talk about next time. Maybe the Cardinals – because Cardinals hadn't even been linked to too many of these people.
They haven't. I mean, right after the Hayward deal, they were linked by Nightingale to Gordon.
Yeah.
That kind of fizzled really fast. They'd never been linked. I mean, even I think when John Morosi tried to connect Davis back to him. The Mosaic shot that down. They never been linked to Cespedes or Upton. Upton kind of seems like a guy. I know about his brother, and I know that he doesn't have the greatest defense, but he just seems like a player that if his demands came down, that he would fit the Cardinals because he gives you pop. He can steal bases. You know, he's played a little bit of center. He's played a little bit of right and left. I mean, he's a guy that can play all over. It just depends on what he wants because, like you said, I don't know what him and Upton, what Cespedes and Upton want. I just haven't seen any offers linked to them. I mean, people jump at the Cespedes with the White Sox thing last night because that's the first time I've ever heard a number by anybody, a blogger or a notable person like Rosenthal or Nightingale attached to Cespedes', you know, to his value. It's just, I mean, Upton seems like a guy who makes more sense for the Cardinals than Davis or Cespedes, but I just don't know what his value is on the open market right now.
Yeah, I mean, Upton, 28 years old. You know, he's averaged 25 home runs back all the way, if you go all the way back to 2009. He's not going to be stellar in the outfield, but, you know, I think you can get by. I mean, I know the Cardinals are playing this run prevention type of game right now, which is basically, you know, a whole bunch of pitching, a whole bunch of good defense, hope that the offense can score the two runs that they need to win. but, you know, it's and I admit that, and I can see that that's a viable strategy. It's obviously worked very well. But, again, like you said, you can't really base yourself on that pitching staff being able to do that, and you would think to get a thumper in the middle of that would be helpful, even if his defense isn't. I mean, he's not terrible. I mean, heck, we play, you know, so we've played some guys that are a little shaky. You know, Matt Adams is no great shakes necessarily at first base, although he's not too bad, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Again, we'll see. The Cardinals most likely will not be in any of these guys, but the longer they're out there, I guess the more likely it is that Mo will circle back around and maybe take another look at it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things where, you know, the Cardinals, they obviously need some. And I know Mozeliak doesn't want to answer offense lineup problems in May. I mean, he doesn't want to be like, because the first question he's going to get from Gould is that you had those guys on the market. I mean, yeah, you know, you lost Hayward, but as I've said many times, he's a good offensive player. But, you know, the return of Hayward, I mean, he wasn't all of a sudden going to hit 25, 30 home runs and drive in 100 runs. I mean, Hayward is what he is. Maybe with a chance for a little bit of a growth because he's entering his prime. But, you know, the question will be, I mean, you had these guys on the open market, and I know they cost money, but you got TV money coming in. You have the open payroll. You have the possibility to do this, and you even have the pieces for a trade. I mean, you didn't do this, and now here we are. If we are in May, we're scoring, you know, 2.5 runs a game, and you have, you know, Wainwright, who could be like 1-5 because he doesn't get any run support, and you don't want to see the chances pass you by. Because I think John Mozeliak's a very smart guy. He's a good businessman. He knows what his team needs and what he's been very good at avoiding bad, long contracts. If he hands out a bad contract, it's usually to Mark Ellis or Ty Wigginton for 1 or 2 years. It's very low liability, and he's never really made that big dip, and that's what makes a deal for like a Chris Davis type, who's just a power hitter, very sexy power hitter, may I add. You know, it makes it very unlikely, but that's not what Mo does. You know, he finds these guys like an Alex Gordon, a guy who's good defense, maybe gives you some offense. He's just a good player, good clubhouse guy. That's why out of all these guys, he still makes the most sense to me. I'm not saying he's the best one, but he just makes the most Mozeliak sense, if there's a way to put it. You know, a guy that maybe he goes back and goes, because Hayward's agent is the same agent as Gordon. Maybe, you know, since he's been talking to Hayward's agent for the past year, essentially, maybe he goes, hey, so how about this Gordon guy? Because Gordon's also still out there. Supposedly, he's told the world he's not coming back to Kansas City, even though it's always a possibility. Mm-hmm. But it's just one of those things where, you know, I mean, I think he has to do something. And I hate to be the guy to go, okay, Mo doesn't know. I mean, of course, Mo knows what he's doing, and he's got a plan that none of us know about. We're reading tweets right now going, ha, 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 these guys think I don't know what I'm doing. I'm going to call Cespedes' agent tomorrow. No, I'm just kidding. But it's just one of those things where I found this winter to be very antsy. And I think it's because Mozeliak did kind of go after, did try to go after Price and he lost. He did try to go after Hayward and he lost. So we've kind of seen Mozeliak take these big swings and misses, and I think we're all just kind of antsy to figure what his next move is.
Yeah. And we'll find out eventually, I guess.
We will. We will. We'll find out. I mean, obviously, the calendar just keeps on turning. So, you know, it isn't like we can stop time and do a 2-hour hot stove. But no. That's not going to happen.
No. It is. Like you say, just right at 6, maybe 7 weeks to pitchers and catchers. And that time goes by quickly. So,
I think it was Birds on the Bat account. I think it said 48 days.
Seems about right, because it's usually right around Valentine's Day when they're reporting. So, like I said, there hadn't been a whole lot more, at least not in Cardinals time period. Before we move on, and we're going to talk a little bit of a year in review, not go in depth with that. That's a UCB project that's coming up, supposed to be tomorrow. We'll see if Dan will have his out probably at one of his various sites. I hopefully will have mine out some point in time. But before we get to that, though, Dan, I think that we ought to talk about the passing of Joe Strauss, who died on Sunday from leukemia. Pretty surprising. I had heard earlier in the week, I think it was about earlier that week, that from somebody that was the rumor that he had leukemia and it wasn't looking good. And unfortunately, that turned out to be true. Strauss had an interesting place, I guess, in the reporting fan sphere. But you probably got a better take on it than I do, so I'll let you go with it right now.
You know, I mean, I wrote something for KSDK. I just think he was a one of a kind journalist. I think he was the kind of guy that didn't really look for fans. He didn't look for people to like what he did. He was, as Ken Rosenthal said, he was a dynamic reporter. He was a guy that made guys like La Russa and Pujols very nervous because he kept coming at him with questions, and they were good questions, and he knew the game really well. He covered the Baltimore Orioles before he came to the Cardinals. He was a guy that was just tenacious, and he picked fights with fans on Twitter just because he liked to make people uncomfortable. That was just his natural ability. I mean, even if you read a guy like Bernie Nicholas, when he wrote something, which was a really beautiful column, this weekend about him, he even made Bernie Nicholas mad. He even made his colleagues. He kind of made him just kind of feel a little uncomfortable. And if you know of him on Twitter, his Twitter profile picture was a hazard sign. It's just, but what you didn't know, and what you found out, especially after his unfortunate death, was that he was a guy who was very caring. You know, wife and kid. He took care of the late journalist Brian Burwell, another columnist for the Post-Dispatch who died a little bit over a year ago. He cared for him a lot in his battle with cancer. And it's very unfortunate. I found out about this in the morning, and it just kind of hit me like in the side of the head, because I heard something from Tim McKernan, a radio show host that Joe Strauss did some segments on. I heard that he told somebody that he was dealing with family problems. And, of course, you think, okay, it's just, there's somebody else that's in trouble, not Joe Strauss. But then you find out that he was diagnosed in January. He had an up-and-down battle with leukemia. He made the trip to Mizzou last month to write about Gary Pinkel and all that stuff. And it was actually his last column. He hadn't written a column in over a few weeks. And that was really the alarm, because we all know as writers, no matter if we're sick, no matter if we're just kind of a little, hobbled up before in bed, we can still tweet, we can still write, we can still interact, our eyes still work, we can still watch sports and analyze. And when that didn't happen, that's always a warning sign. Because that happened with Brian Burwell. Brian Burwell kind of stopped, he stopped tweeting, he stopped writing, and that's when the warning signs really went up. But just like Burwell, Strauss never made this about him. I mean, even Bernie said that he wouldn't like all the good things people were saying about him. Is that just not what Joe Strauss would do? He'd probably just wave it off and go, whatever. While he's, putting on that scruffy leather coat and the baseball cap that looks like it spent about a year out in the desert with R2-D2 and, getting sand all over it. But, my one story that I'll share as I ramble on here about Joe Strauss, but I covered the 2014 winter warm-up, and in typical fashion, Joe Strauss made me very angry. Mm-hmm. And, he came in late for Matt Holliday's media session. Matt Holliday came, and of course, they asked him about Johnny Peralta, who was just acquired 2 months before that. And you know, position. And Strauss came rumbling in, his shoes with no socks and his ruffled brown leather coat, and he basically looked like Columbo if Columbo was a baseball writer.
I mean, you imagine Peter Falk in a media session, that was Joe Strauss. But he came in and he kind of sat down, he kind of looked at all of us, and he was like, so did Matt Holliday do his usual moral police thing about PEDs, performance-enhancing drugs? And, of course, you know, my immediate reaction was, well, no, he didn't, you know what I mean? Because I'm a Matt Holliday fan. Mm-hmm. I'm a guy who knows that, you know, Matt Holliday was powerless. Matt Holliday can't tell John Mosley, like, hey, I don't like this guy, you can't sign him. But that was what Joe did. He would get you fired up, and he would make you re-examine everything you thought about that. So I had to re-examine what I thought about Holliday, what I thought about PEDs, what I thought about Peralta. He did that to you, and it was effortless. It was with one line. It was almost like he could have put that into a tweet, and he wouldn't have gotten 155 retweets. He wouldn't have gotten all kinds of comments. He wouldn't have lit Twitter on fire by taking one of the town's most popular players, Matt Holliday, and making him out to be a moral police guy on PEDs. And that's just what he did. It was a gift, because it's so hard, man. It's so hard when you're covering a team to say something very venomous, very mean about the team, you know, and have the courage to stand there and kind of take the heat. Because, and he did that. He did that with Pujols. Pujols nicknamed him El Diablo. I mean, Tony La Russa, there's a video out there on YouTube where Tony La Russa just goes off on him. You can't see Joe Strauss, but, you know, you just see those two get in a really big heated battle, and that happened a lot. And, you know, Joe Strauss, he was a guy that had the courage to go, to run at a topic instead of running away from it. A lot of writers, even I have sat there and went, you know, do I really want to write this story? Do I really want to start this? Or do I just want to back away and let somebody else write it, and then I'll just respond to it? Because that's a lot safer to do when you're a writer, a young writer, an older writer, doesn't matter. I mean, but Joe Strauss had the courage to tell the story no matter what happened to his profile, no matter what happened to his reputation. He was just that kind of guy, and that kind of guy usually isn't likable. You know, he usually isn't going to be the guy that goes out there and goes, I love all my followers. You guys are great. Let's talk. No, he's a guy that just gave you blunt answers. He was a reporter turned columnist who, even though how much I didn't like him on Twitter or how much he made me angry, when he wrote an article, I had to read it because I want to know what Joe thought. And I wanted to measure what he thought against what I thought. And it's almost like you wanted to your thoughts to spar with Joe's thoughts and see who would win over a 12-round fight. And that's just what he did. And like I said, he was a one-of-a-kind guy. And, you know, if I do get the pleasure to cover the warm-up this year, it's going to be a missing presence in that media room without Joe there. Because Joe would just sit there and he would fire questions at these players. And a lot of reporters were there that were really good, Derek Gould, Jennifer LaGosche, to name two. Joe would just sit there kind of like a professor, just kind of reading the player, reading him and reading his thoughts, and then he would just fire a zinger that would just go through the player's shoulder, so to speak, and make him really kind of react. And players kind of had to load up to answer his questions, and they had to get ready. And that's just a perfect kind of journalist, whether you like him or not.
For the last number of years, I in the March run what I call the Cardinal approval ratings, which basically put out the form. Everybody can rate the people on the form from 0 to 100, average it out. We see roughly how these people are being received, and usually, you know, except players, media, front office, all that kind of stuff. Put Joe on there starting in 2011. I pulled this up, and every year but one, he was under 60% when people did the voting. A couple years, he was under 55%. He got on people's nerves, and I'll admit, he got on my nerves too. and I would not have approached. I think that he could have done as good of a job as he did and still been a little bit more, I don't want to say accommodating, but maybe a little more tactful with the fan base. He lived to rile them up, and that's just, I mean, and there's no doubt about it, because there were times, I mean, it really felt like he'd go out of his way to do that. You know, he seemed to sneer at sabermetrics quite regularly. He I think he probably blocked more people than and probably for good reason on a lot of those, because he did rile people up, and I'm sure his mentions at times were pretty ugly on Twitter. I think that, you know, Joe's probably acquired taste to some degree because of that. But, you know, and he, you know, his idea of teasing that something big was going to be on the website at midnight, and wasn't always the case. But it did seem that when Joe was the beat writer, if it was breaking news, Joe broke it. I mean, and he knew what he was talking about, and he knew how to report. Let's put it that way. I felt like, again, even before he shifted it to columnist, he had a little bit more commentary in his game stories, if you will, kind of mixing that in a little bit more, and perhaps
that's he definitely did.
And I think that's probably one reason they went ahead and moved him to columnist over the last couple of years and promoted Gould up to beat writer, and you don't see that quite as much in Derek's writing. But there's, again, all that to say is not to discount what Joe Strauss did. And like you said, it was interesting to hear of the behind-the-scenes stories of him being that kind of, you know, more generous person behind the scenes and quietly. And that's admirable as well. There's no need to blow your own horn on that. It probably is more important and more impressive that he did those things, you know, behind the scenes. But, you know, there's times where he was going back and forth with BJ Reigns or Jim Hayes or even Derek Gould at times. I think for a while there, I may be wrong, but I don't think Strauss was following Gould or you know, vice versa. I think Derek would say something of the fact that, you know, he wasn't able to see Joe's tweet, so he didn't know what Joe had said because Joe wasn't. Wasn't following him or something of that nature. But, you know, it seemed at times that Joe was on odds with just about everybody else in St. Louis media. Now, again, what you see on a screen, what you see in various things is not necessarily representative of their actual relationships. And obviously it wasn't, as we've heard some very kind and very good things since Joe's passing. But I don't know if you remember, it's kind of interesting that, you know, he had about 1 year where he was on Fox Sports Midwest pre-games. They would interview, they'd talk to him before the games as part of a little segment.
Yeah.
They don't do that anymore. I don't know if I got the idea. Joe was a little too honest for the rights holders, as he would like to call it. And they don't really do that. Which is unfortunate. I would have liked to seen them talk to him, talk to Derek, some of these other people, that they don't do that as much anymore. But anyway, it's a sad thing. I mean, it's gotta be tough on his family. You know, his daughter was going to, I think, just went to college. His wife, I don't know, they've been married for a significant amount of time. It is difficult for his friends. And like I said, the coverage of the Cardinals and of Missouri sports in general is probably diminished significantly by his passing. And it's hard to say. I mean, he's 54. That's not as old as it used to be. You know, you start getting a little bit uncomfortable with numbers like that when you get to my age, at least. So
it's been a really rough year for the Post-Dispatch. I mean, they lost Brian Burwell last December 4th. They lost Joe Williams, a film critic that I knew very well, in a car accident over the summer. And, you know, and Bernie left for 101 Sports in August, and then, you know, you have Joe Strauss. It's just really kind of getting. I mean, they're really getting hammered hard. I mean, it has to be a very different newsroom. I mean, if any newsroom deserves a drink, it's the St. Louis Post-Dispatch right now. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, let's take that and transition into what this last year has looked like for the Cardinals. You know, if you were to pick, and then you know, I don't want to say top story because that'll just ruin whatever post you're doing, but probably, let's just say three things. Doesn't have to be what you're on your post, but just three things that you will remember about the 2015 season.
I think the first thing, and it's Carlos Martinez, the fact that he started the year as, you know, hopefully this guy gives us five innings. Hopefully he could be a fifth starter. We don't know what he is. He's too erratic emotionally. He can't do this. And all of a sudden, by the end of the year, he was the popular reason that, you know, fans said that the Cardinals couldn't stand up to the Cubs. I mean, he was a guy who pitched very well under pressure. He had top of the rotation stuff. He was good on the road. He was good at home. And when he went down, that was kind of a real big kick in the hole of the bottom of the ship. And it's just one of those things where I think his growth in this season is the first thing I think about when I think about the most memorable things of this season, the things that really surprises me. Yeah, John Lackey, he might find his way in that list just because of nobody expected him to have that kind of a year, even if he pitched admirably in 2014 the way he pitched last year. And another guy I think about is Steve Biscotti, because I think about if Steve Biscotti hadn't come around, this offense may have averaged under 2 runs a game. Just because when he came on in late July and just started producing runs, no matter if he was hitting 2, 6, 5, 7, it's just a guy that, yeah, we don't know what the full season Biscotti is going to bring us, you know. And just the way that he had that big collision in the outfield. He came back. He was probably the best hitter against the Cubs in NLDS. He was a guy that just he started to show more power as he played. You know, of course, he adjusted his power stroke for the 2015 season. He was a guy that arrived. You know, it was like seeing hype and reality meet. I mean, you know, he was the guy that was supposed to come up here and, you know, hopefully be good enough to play, and he was really good. He hit for average. He slugged. You know, he got on base. He was a good defender. He's a guy that was able to play first base. He's a guy that, you know, could be playing first base or right field or left field. He's kind of like, if you take away the second base, he's kind of like his reputation as a right-hand hitting Carpenter is a very accurate comparison, because it's just what he does. He hits. You know, he hits. He never really seems to go into a long spell where he didn't hit. He's a very smart hitter. He's a very smart guy. The guy's a Stanford graduate in the engineering department. So, you know, if he doesn't happen to make it, or he just gets tired of baseball, he can make a very good living for himself. But he's just a very impressive individual. And then, you know, there's the third guy. I mean, I think it was Hayward. I mean, I think Hayward, the way that he did come here with the expectations to fill right field and to be a player that the Cardinals could rely on. And here's a guy who, after a rough first month, he hit pretty steady from May 1st to the end of the season. He batted in the second spot, the third spot. He found his home in the fourth spot. You know, he had that big game against the Pirates. He had several big hits. He had the big throw from right field at Wrigley Field to nail Rizzo at the plate. He was a guy that just, I mean, the only reason you really hate losing a guy is because of how good he was and how good he could have been in the Cardinal uniform over the next decade. And the fact that he came here and gave us that glimpse of what he could do, you know, a 6 WAR player, a guy who was a great base runner, a good hitter, an extra great right fielder with a good arm and range. He had it all. And he's definitely, well, if I had to name three guys that really made me think back about the season in good terms, it was Carlos Martinez, Biscotti, and probably Jason Hayward, even though Matt Carpenter probably edges in there with his ability to hit for power and the way he kind of came back after a rough patch. But those three guys are probably my guys that I think of as far as stories.
Well, I mean, obviously, yeah, you're right. Obviously Hayward is there. Not only, I mean, I know the trade was late last year, but, you know, from his introduction at winter warm-up to, you know, his season-long contributions to the whole idea of the Cardinals are going to sign him or not to the final, you know, dramatics of him going to the Cubs. I mean, that 2015 is Hayward's year, there's no doubt. And like you said, to seeing the other guys perform is huge as well. You got to remember, this is a team that won 100 games. Somehow, some way. It doesn't seem like a team that won 100 games, but, you know, it's the first team to do that since 2011 in the Phillies. A team that had some historic pitching all the way around was pretty incredible. I mean, you got to look at that. You look at the injuries. You got to remember injuries from this year, which is what makes 100 even more impressive. You got the hacking scandal this year. You know, that was something that has kind of been quiet lately. Haven't heard much about since the firing of Chris Correa. It would hopefully be that's because there's not that much left to do. But we'll find out, I'm sure, at some point in time in 2016 if the FBI has anything else. There's lots of different things that we're going to be we'll probably look back in 10 years and talk about this team. But I think, like you said, I think Hayward's the biggest thing, because I think that shadow weaves through just about everything else that went on this year. So it's an interesting year. It's hard to believe that, you know, this is the first team that didn't make the NLCS since 2011. A team that probably, for the fact that 100 games, was not a favorite going into the playoffs, and obviously showed that. A first team to play the Cubs in the postseason and did not have a very good success with that. Unfortunately, that was historic as well, and something that Cub fans may mention a few more times until the Cardinals get a chance to knock the Cubs out of the playoffs. Hopefully, maybe that'll be next year. That would be nice. we will take that. All right, I think that's about all we got on the baseball side of things. Like I said, it's just that time of quiet year of year that's just not much going on, and we'll be ramping up for spring training soon. But as we always do, we end with the entertainment section, and then odds are this is going to be a little bit longer than normal, because there's this little billion-dollar movie that came out. Star Wars The Force Awakens is now 9th overall, and it hasn't even been out 2 weeks in the overall box office, all-time box office take, not adjusted for inflation, all that kind of stuff. But still, Dan, you know, I know that you are typically our entertainment expert, and I will still let you go first, but this is home field for me, so
definitely.
I know you've written on it. I know you've seen it. I don't know if you've seen it once or.
I have seen it once. Okay. I'm probably gonna take. I'm gonna take the kid to see it now that it's kind of died down. I'm gonna try to take the kid to see it. It said he'll probably be in theaters till next October.
Well, no, they gotta get it out of there before Rogue One comes out next December. So
you're right. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've seen it once. I went and saw it for the third time last night.
Heck yeah.
So, and still want to go see it in 3D. Still want to go see it IMAX. Those are plans for January, but what'd you think?
You know, I was really impressed by it. I mean, I just, the first thing I said in my review was thank you, J.J. Abrams, just because he's, for the second time, he has kind of regenerated. He's stuck an old franchise in a generator, and he's plugged it in and has rebooted it in the greatest form possible. He did it with Star Trek. I wasn't a Star Trek fan until Abrams really touched that franchise and made it, you know, fresh and fun and kinetic and action-packed and just a different way. And he did that with Star Wars. I mean, I'll admit that I'm not a Star Wars addict, but I'm a big fan of the original three, or what they're called now, episodes 4 through 6. But yeah, I thought he did a good job of bringing the older characters back from the earlier films, while introducing new characters and getting us invested in people like Rey. Is that her name? Daisy Ridley's character, Rey. Rey and Finn and Poe. I'm a big Oscar Isaacs fan, so when I saw him in the trailer, I was like, okay, this is going to be really good. At the very least, you got a very talented actor like Oscar Isaacs, who's played in a bunch of indies. He's a very accomplished lesbian actor who just does everything, every kind of genre. So to see him kind of take over that hotshot role, maybe kind of take over the, you know, the Harrison Ford kind of Han Solo kind of persona. It was kind of – I kind of saw this movie as kind of a handoff. It was kind of a handoff from the older characters to these new characters. But it isn't like Abrams just kind of shoved the older crowd away. I mean, he had them interact. He had the story kind of come forward that, you know, that the good guys, they haven't really had a good time since the Return of the Jedi, and they've kind of struggled a little bit. I mean, we see the Millennium Falcon's basically sitting in a dusty crop owned by a mercenary guy, and – it's just you
you're introduced to these new characters. We have a new bad guy in M Driver's Kylo Ren, who's just very mad but disobedient, and kind of he's obviously been turned bad. And I really like the way they didn't rush the plot. They kind of just laid out these new characters, showed us the old ones, put forth all these guys, and slowly the story kind of came together. I just felt like it was a very patient movie. You think a lot of directors want to just take in this material and fire their best shots in the first hour. But, you know, Abrams, he spread it out over the whole running time. He left me wanting more. He left me wanting, you know, these two characters, I won't give it all away, these two characters to share a few words at the end of the movie. But he didn't. You know, he got your attention in a big way, and now he's going to hold it. And it's not an easy endeavor, man. I mean, there's a lot of big projects. There's the Marvel Avengers, where Josh Whedon had to mix all these big personalities together. Zack Snyder's trying it this year with the DC characters, with Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, and Aquaman, and even Doomsday for some crazy reason. You know, but for Abrams to bring these characters back and introduce new ones and make it very interesting, I think that this movie could be appreciated by people who have seen the prequels, who have seen all six movies beforehand, or maybe even people that haven't seen them. And they'll watch this movie, and then they'll go back and watch the other movies. I think it's a movie that you can put anybody in a seat and go, you're going to watch this movie, that, you know, the lights are going to go down, and all of a sudden that music is just going to captivate you. And I will admit that there were chills going down my spine when the first thing started and the scroll started to go up. I was like, oh, man, it's happening. Hopefully they can get it right. And let me tell you, folks, diehard fan, casual fan, or just a fan of old, good school cinema, you're going to really enjoy this movie. I mean, don't get turned off by the, you know, people like Choctaw who are just diehard fans. I think people are getting, some people are like, I don't want to watch it just to be the person that doesn't watch it. Don't be that person. Go watch it. The worst thing that I can possibly see on the internet is people slamming the movie without seeing the movie. This is a rule I have with any movie, and for people that slam movies before you see them, you have to see it before you can have a critique on it. You have to sit there and, you know, taste the dish before you can go, okay, this piece of pie stinks, you know, because you never know. Some of these big critics of the movies are ones that don't want to like it. They may just love it, and then they have to admit that they love it. They get a Facebook post or Twitter post, okay, I was wrong, it was great. And, well, like I said, I wasn't impressed with the prequels, as everybody else. I just found holes in the stories and the casting. But I wanted a return to the older films, but I also wanted a fresh dose of something for the future to look forward to. And Abrams, he did all of that. He took this very monstrous task, and he made it look easy as far as just melding the characters together and the story. You know, people complain about the story, like, you know, look, this is Star Wars. It doesn't have to be a complex story. There's good, there's bad, there's gray. They all kind of mix in. I got a big kick out of this movie. Shop talk, take the floor.
Well, first of all, I should have prefaced this whole talk by there will be spoilers. If you haven't seen the movie in 2 weeks, I mean, you deserve to be spoiled. But also, you know, this is all we got left. If you don't want to listen to us talk on Star Wars, you can go ahead and turn us off because we're done. Or you just want to skip the rest and then come back to it after you've seen the movie, that's fine too. Like I said, I was over there opening night. I went and saw it Christmas Eve. I went and saw it last night. My initial walking out of the first time was that it was very good, but I was slightly disappointed in the fact that it was a bit of a rehash of episode 4. There were some beats, there were some obvious things. You know, you have the escape from the Empire's, you know, big thing. You have the desert planet and a droid starting this whole thing off. You have big blow up thing at the end. There were lots of things that were still similar to A New Hope, and not that they didn't do it well, and not that it made it a bad movie. It was just that it was a little bit repetitive. Now, after watching it a couple more times, I think that feeling has faded somewhat. I think you can appreciate what it is. But I, as you said, I think it's a place, it's a movie that if you haven't seen Star Wars, you go see this one and you're fine. All you need to know is what's in the pop culture now. Of, you know Luke Skywalker's a Jedi. You know Leia's his sister. You know Han Solo's a smuggler type. You know he's a rebel type thing. That's all you need to know, because everything else is in this movie. And it's a great starting spot, and it sets up 8 and probably 9 very well. It was unsurprising, the big death, the loss of Han Solo. I don't think anybody was surprised at that. I didn't know that it was coming, but it did not surprise me. Seeing a lot of Harrison Ford lately, and I think that was partly because he wasn't going to be around for 8 and 9. It also... he got to have his moment, and whether he will, there's some idea. I think there's some talk about he's under contract for the next movie, perhaps as a flashback, perhaps as a, ghost, not a force ghost, but more of a, memories or something of that nature. I don't think we're going to have to worry about him being alive. They did a pretty good job, of that. You stab a guy, you throw him off a bridge, and then you leave him in the middle of an exploding planet. Not real easy to come back from that. Comic books, yeah, maybe, but I don't think you're going to see that in Star Wars. Kylo Ren is... my feeling on Kylo Ren or Ben Solo, or which is interesting, Kylo Ren, Solo Ben, I don't know if that's why he chose it. Honestly, probably has something to do with that. But anyway, I think it's the first time we're not seeing the strongest, the best of the best on the dark side. I don't think he is an extremely skilled force user. We've seen, again, there's some idea that Rey has had some training in her past, that she was trained before she was left on Jakku, so she has at least the, maybe subconscious knowledge of how to use the force, but she's still able to resist him in numerous times and best him in lightsaber combat. My feeling is he comes across, and maybe that's just Adam Driver, and maybe that's just the way it's supposed to. He comes across as trying to be the big bad guy, but almost like a kid playing at it. He's not necessarily that strong on the dark side yet. Now, the end of the movie, Supreme Commander Smoke, or Supreme Leader Smoke, Stoke, says that he's going to complete Ren's training, and that maybe we'll see a more powerful, more Vader-ish Dark Lord in the next movie. I don't know.
Yeah, he definitely could be kind of an adolescent bad guy. I mean, maybe he's still kind of learning. Obviously, he was trained by Luke, and he resisted him, and he still needs, like Smoke says, maybe he needs to be that, he needs to have his training be completed. And, of course, he's also maybe a guy who was really, as we saw in that scene with Solo, he was still dancing with the idea of being good. And now, when he said, told Solo, okay, thank you. Thank you for now making me a big bad guy. Now I can complete that mission.
It also makes me feel like there's not a redemption story here. Not saying it's impossible, but I don't know that, we saw some... George Lucas liked to say his movies rhymed, that one rhymed with four and such, so on. And we saw some heavy rhyming between 4 and 7 here. I don't know that the whole trilogy is going to go that way. I think this was kind of a familiar, here's your story, here's the ground you're used to before maybe you branch off. I don't think we see a redemption story out of this. I mean, one, it's tough to say, hey, this guy killed Han Solo, now he's a good guy. I mean, it's one thing to slaughter younglings, 30 years before, but when we actually see him kill Han Solo, that's going to be a bridge too far for a lot of people. So, I don't think that's coming.
He killed his dad too. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
It would almost be like when Luke finds out that, oh, you're my father. Okay, Darth, I'm just gonna stab you more now.
Yeah.
Well. It makes this guy very sinister, and maybe something that really launches, Rey and Finn into really a more of a vengeance role for next time.
Yeah. And it's going to be interesting to see where they pick up. Do they pick up right after? They pick up 3 years later? Is this time period of training? I don't know. And that's going to be kind of fun. Yeah, I went into this, you know, having seen the trailers, you know, kind of knew who Rey was, kind of knew who Finn was just from the trailers, you know, and Daisy Ridley was incredible. It was awesome to see them pretty much turn the rescuing tropes on their heads. You know, she's the one that saves herself. She's the one pulling Finn out of the fire a lot of times. You know, she's already gotten out of her jail cell when they come to rescue her. She was very good in it. I mean, all the way around. And I enjoyed Finn. I enjoyed the humor that he brought to it. But like, you know, like you said, Poe was, and Oscar Isaac was incredible. I mean, I didn't know a whole lot about Poe, you know, except he wasn't going to be this focus. But I mean, he kind of grabbed the movie from the very beginning. I felt like, you know, are you going to talk? Am I going to talk? You know, how does
that
go?
That was so much humor. I mean, because he's just like, you know, you think he's going to be afraid of him. Like, no, do I talk? Do you talk? Is this so serious? Yeah. It's funny though, in sitting down with JJ, that he was supposed to die early on.
Yeah.
And then and obviously they saw how good he was. Probably okay, we're going to give you a bigger role. But
yeah,
Oscar Isaac. I mean, he's played a folk singer in Inside Llewellyn Davis. He's played a mayor on an HBO miniseries. He can play anything. I mean, he's a chameleon. I mean, he could just go from here to there. And so when I saw him in the trailers playing this pilot, I mean, this hot shot, I was like, this is going to be good, because he never swings and misses. He never phones in a performance like you see with so many actors. I knew that when he got in there, it was a familiar face, but not just that, but a familiar talent, because he's very good at what he does.
Yeah. And you know, the tracking shot of him, and it's not him, I mean, that's not his acting there, because it's the tracking shot of his X-Wing flying over Takodata at Maz Kanata's castle, and just that tracking shot that follows him shooting TIE fighter after TIE fighter and dropping bombs, and just this one continuous take following him around. It was, I think, the best shot of the movie. I think that was just incredible to watch that, and to see him see that flying. I mean, you really believe that Poe Dameron was the best pilot out there. I mean, we hear a lot about Luke Skywalker being a great pilot or Han Solo being a great pilot, and we see a little bit of that, but I don't think we have ever seen maybe in the prequels, because of the technology they had, you know, some of the Battle of Coruscant and Revenge of the Sith, some interesting flying there, but you know, for the most part, just to see that swooping around and just, you know, it was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, maybe this is Abrams kind of showing you that, hey, I'm going to have even better characters, like with Rey and Finn and Poe. Maybe if you thought, you know, the earlier heroes are great, well, I'm going to have these even better heroes. And for people that didn't catch it, Daniel Craig did play a stormtrooper. Mm-hmm. He is the one that Rey puts under mind control.
Yeah.
That's the biggest rumor, is that it was James Bond. Stormtrooper, yes, he was. And that's just another example of these actors who probably just are Star Wars fanatics sneaking in. He was the one, and if he spoke, I should have caught it, but he spoke, he goes, yes, I'm going to drop my weapon and then leave you and leave the door open. And that was Daniel Craig, folks. And that's just another cool little tidbit I found out about after the movie.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, because, you know, that came out before the movie, and he said, you know, basically, why in the heck would I do that? You know, I'm not going to be an extra in a movie. And then, yeah, it turned out he actually was in the movie, so he did a pretty good job of misdirection. You know, I thought Maz Kanata was a great character. You know, I knew I didn't know what that was going to be like with CGI. You know, obviously, Abrams did a lot less CGI characters, but she was very believable. I mean, I believe, you know, it was a very believable character, even though it was obviously not human. She was a fun character, and it'd be interesting to see if that, you know, if they go back to her at some point in time. You know, all in all, it was just, like I said, except for the fact that you're blowing up a world buster again, which, you know, has been done. This is the fourth of the seven movies where they've, you know, flown and blown something up in space, because you had the two Death Stars and you had the droid control ship of the Phantom Menace. You know, these things tend to get a little repetitive, but you know, on the whole, it was great. I mean, there was humor in it. That's not how the Force works. you know, there was you know, BB-8 was awesome.
He was great. I mean, that just tells you that, you know, I mean, as cool as R2-D2 was, you can create another one that's even cooler That was a pretty impressive achievement.
Yeah, I mean, and I mean, rolling balls are always interesting, but you know, the thumbs up he gives Finn that was incredible. It's just the emotion. I mean, I don't want to say emotion, maybe, but the expressiveness that you got out of a robot was pretty incredible. You know, again, good to see Luke, good to see Leia, good to see Han. It would have been nice to see Luke a little bit more than just the last second, but, you know, I get that. I mean,
that's teasing. It's teasing the crowd for more.
Well, and as the you know, Michael Arndt, who first wrote the story, it got rewritten then by Abrams and Kasdan. You know, he pretty much said, hey, look, every time Luke, as soon as Luke gets on the screen, you want to know what Luke's doing. You don't care about these other people. You want to know what Luke Skywalker's doing. And they couldn't figure out a way to get him into this movie without him overshadowing everything. And
yeah,
I think it works well. I think, you know, that the last bit, I would have liked to have him say something. I kept waiting for some sort of, you know, comment,
I mean,
or line or something.
I mean, my comment would have been, why didn't you bring coffee and the lightsaber?
Well, he had a plate there, so he may have had some coffee somewhere.
There you go.
Way.
Okay.
But,
okay.
Yeah, it was. It was, and I mean, anytime you get to see the Millennium Falcon again, it's a good day.
You
know, and
especially in action.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when I couldn't help it. I have watched this movie three times, and every time when Rey starts to fly it and it starts bouncing off the ground and crashing into stuff and scraping the ground, I'm always cringing because I'm like, don't ruin the ship, man. You know, I mean, you can't be doing that to that ship. I haven't met.
That's the holy grail of movie spaceships.
You know, I mean, I have numerous Millennium Falcons around my house and an office, so you know, that's my ship. I hate to see it get beat up even more than the piece of junk it is already. So, I don't know. I mean, all the way around, it was a very good movie. It's worth, like you said, going to see even if you haven't seen it. Well, if you haven't seen it now, we've probably ruined it for you. But I think you should still go see it because it's worth seeing the journey. It's the joys of the journey, if you will.
It's the one movie you have to see on the big screen too. I mean, you can have a 70-inch screen at home. You can have a garage movie theater, but you have to go watch this movie with somewhat of a crowd. People are still packing the theaters with this movie. It's something that you have to experience. I mean, and that's something that even a guy like me, I see a lot of movies, but I'll admit that even a half of them, 60% maybe even, that you don't have to see in a movie theater. You can appreciate it at home with a good sound system and be fine. You know, turn the lights off, you know, get the popcorn going, and you can still get the same experience. But with Star Wars, you have to see it. You need that movie theater sound. I mean, if I was in St. Louis, I would go watch this in IMAX. I would go watch it at the Science Center in a heartbeat. The fact that they're showing it in the OmniMax is just ridiculous. I mean, if I had a jet outside my apartment, I would go there right now and watch it and come right back. I mean, if I knew Tony Stark, this would be done by now. But it's a movie that you have to experience. I mean, you know, watch it, and if you hate it, you hate it. I mean, but you have to at least go watch it. It's a movie that I think everybody should watch, and there's rarely any movies like that. I mean, there's movies that I'll go, I think everybody should watch this, but probably not everybody. But this is a movie that everybody should just go watch and experience. And hey, you know, if you don't like it, that just creates amazing conversation.
Yeah, it's incredible. It'll be out on DVD, Blu-ray, which there will be plenty of Blu-ray jokes about that time, in April,
yes.
Beginning of April, which is interesting, a short turnaround time for that.
And the beginning of the baseball season too. So you're going to have two crushes in 1 week.
That's right. You know, again, then we take our attention. We've got, thankfully, you know, back in the old days, you had to wait 3 years. Now you wait a year and a half. Year and a half to episode 8. But even before then, next December, you've got Rogue One, which is if you don't know about Rogue One, it's the movie that they are setting up that it's a kind of a war movie with a group of people that are stealing the first Death Star plans. These are not the Bothans that died to get you the second plans. These are the people that steal the first plans and then beam them to Princess Leia that starts off episode 4. Should be a fascinating, should be interesting. I'm very interested to see not only that movie, but how Disney markets it, how Disney approaches a non-episode Star Wars. It's going to be very, very fascinating to see how they do that. And how much of this audience that's going to see Episode 7 turns out for a movie that has no Jedi, that has no Skywalkers, probably will have a little bit of Darth Vader, but is a supporting, you know, occasional role. I'm very interested to see how this goes. I think that's a real good test of the Star Wars brand.
Definitely.
I could talk about it all night long, and, you know, I have numerous ideas and thoughts about it, but I don't know that anybody else wants to hear them. So, Dan, anything else you want to talk about before we wrap it up?
Not really. I mean, I think that's the one movie that's out there to see. I would tell people that if you're a Quentin Tarantino fan, you'll really enjoy The Hateful Eight. It's a Tarantino joint as far as bringing great actors together and making a piece of history, like even the post-Civil War unjust with all these mercenaries and cowboys and killers meeting in a bar and kind of having – I mean, if Hunger Games was made by Quentin Tarantino, it would be called The Hateful Eight. It's a movie that's enjoyable. It's got the great writing of Tarantino. There's also Concussion. You can't talk about football these days without talking about Will Smith's new movie where he plays the doctor who – you know, identify this disease of the brain called CTE that is happening and being found in ex-football players who played in the 70s and the 80s and even recently with Junior Seau. So it's a very important movie. I can't look at football the same way now that I've seen it, just because once you see what happens when these guys clash and the way they're being tackled, at least back in the day. It's going to affect you if you're a parent. It's going to affect you if you're a football fan. I'm going to be interviewing my old high school, the guy with the same high school who still coaches football at my high school. I'm going to interview him about it because they're actually teaching kids how to tackle in a different way. So it's the movies having a lot of effects on people, and rightly so, because what the NFL did to make an extra buck and abandon its player's safety is pretty ridiculous, and it's going to make you really re-examine your whole love for football. It won't make you not watch it. I'm still going to watch football, but it's going to be hard to watch it in the same way if you see this movie. So go watch Concussion, and there's plenty of movies to see in the holiday season, but, you know, Hateful Eight, you know, Star Wars and Concussion, you have a little bit of something for everybody.
That's right. There's something out there. It's interesting to see that. I think they said that some of these other movies have actually brought in more than expected because of kind of Star Wars overflow. People are already going out, so it's been a good December for the movie industry, and we'll see how long that continues. Dan and I will come back at you sometime early January. We'll still kind of figure out what we're going to do. Depends on what the Cardinals do between now and then. We'll probably at least... Dan will be covering winter warm up, so we may try to get a show in before then. But definitely. Hopefully soon. But that will wrap 2015. We've done 23 episodes this year. Appreciate y'all listening to us, and hopefully you'll continue to do so in 2016. So for Dan Buffa, I'm Daniel Stoptaw. Good night. Thanks for listening to The Best Dance in Baseball. We'd love to have your feedback on the show. Email us at bestdansinbaseball@gmail.com. Dan Buffa can be found on Twitter at Buffa82, Daniel Shoptaw at C70. The show's Twitter handle is bestdan, BASEBAL1. You can also find us on Facebook under Best Dance in Baseball.